proclaiming the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Shalom and welcome to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. My name is Aaron Broughton. I'm your host for today, and I want to thank you for joining me today. Over the past programs, we've been looking at Bible geography by taking a land tour of the Holy Land, visiting special places both past and present. Last time, we visited the Dung Gate, which is on the south side of the Old City of Jerusalem. Here we walked through this gate and spent some time looking at the archaeological park that showcased some of the remains of some homes from the time of the Second Temple. We were able to see the stones from the ancient temple that the Roman soldiers of Titus threw down that fulfilled the prophecy of Jesus mentioned in Matthew chapter 24. We also spent some time at the Western, or Wailing Wall, as it is sometimes called. In Hebrew, it is known as the Kotel. Jewish people, and many from around the world, come to this spot to pray, and even to write their requests on paper and place them in the wall. During Rosh Hashanah in September, this wall is cleaned of all the paper that is put in the wall. The cleaning crew then will bury these papers in respect, as they may have the name of God written upon them. Going back outside of Dung Gate, we now turn the corner of the Temple Mount going north on our way to the Eastern Gate. Now as we walk, you will notice the southern steps of the Temple Mount that led to Solomon's Porch. You can see it right there on the left. They were built in a staggering fashion so that one cannot just run up the steps, but must carefully think on his path on his way up to the house of the Lord. You will see also the three entrances that are closed up called the Huldah Gates, which served as entrances to the temple platform. Today you will see above here the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which was built in 705 AD by the Umayyads. Looking again at the excavated areas below, you will see many mikvot, or Jewish ritual cleansing baths. This area is special, as I believe that this is where the miracle of Pentecost took place. After Peter preached his message found in Acts chapter 2, 3,000 were saved and baptized. Now I think instead of going all the way to the Jordan River on a feast day of all days, I believe they were baptized simply here. It seems to fit the picture much better because the mikvot and the ritual cleansing bath really is what we would think is baptism. Really, baptism came from that practice as we know it today. Now we come to the eastern side of the Old City. We are now in the Kidron Valley, looking up at the huge walls that surround the Eastern Gate. This gate is also called the Golden Gate. It is divided into two parts that have been sealed since 1541 by the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. On the north side is the Gate of Repentance, and on the south side is the Gate of Mercy. In fact, in Hebrew, this gate is called Sa'ar Rechamim. According to Jewish tradition, the Shekinah glory of God once was shown here. Jews used to pray here for the mercy of God to replace this blocked gate with a new one for the Messiah. Today, the entrance of the Eastern Gate is blocked by Muslim graves in an effort to stop any Messiah from entering. We know, according to Ezekiel chapter 44, that the prince will one day enter into this gate to restore Jerusalem and establish proper worship and order at the temple. We look forward to this day when Jesus, the Messiah, will enter into the city of Jerusalem through this very gate. Nothing will stop him, not even a cemetery. Even though the Bible says there will be dark days ahead for this city, there also is a bright and glorious future led by none other than Jesus the Messiah. What a day that will be. Truly, the Eastern Gate and the Old City of Jerusalem gives us a unique view into the mystery of this special place. It is definitely a favorite of mine, as well as for many other visitors and pilgrims who come to the Holy Land. From ancient history to the current people and future events, there is something to learn and appreciate at every turn. I invite you to join us again, as we will visit the gates of the Old City of Jerusalem in our tour of Bible geography in the land of Israel. The next stop on our journey is just a little bit farther from the Eastern Gate where we just were, and that is Lion's Gate, also called St. Stephen's Gate. Fascinating history behind there. So I invite you to come along with us and invite a friend as well. I also just wanted to mention to you, our listeners, that IBJM is actually hosting a special study tour to Israel this coming March. And this is definitely a trip of a lifetime. I invite you to come along with us this coming March. With this in mind, let's now open our Bibles and our hearts as we stand together with our teacher and Jewish believer, Brother Mark Oshman, with today's Bible lesson.
Welcome back to our radio broadcast. We've been looking at New Testament times, including the lifestyles and beliefs of people during the first century AD. In our last session, we left off by discussing Gnosticism and its various beliefs. The basic Gnostic myth had many variations, all of which referred to entities called aeons. These aeons functioned as intermediate beings. They occupy the plateau of existence between that of the ultimate true God and the human race. Together with the true God, aeons comprise the realm of fullness, known by the Greek term pleroma. The realm of fullness wherein the potency of divine life operates fully. Pleroma, or fullness, stood in contrast to the existential state of the human race, according to Gnostic belief. By comparison, the existential state of the human race was vain and had no value. It was empty. One of these aeons was known as Sophia, the Greek word for wisdom. Sophia, or wisdom, became the creator of the material and psychic cosmos. This entity, according to Gnostic doctrine, fashioned all of creation in the image of its own flaw. Unaware of its origins, Sophia, or wisdom, envisioned itself as the ultimate and absolute God. According to Gnostic belief, therefore, Sophia took the already existing divine essence and fashioned that substance into various forms. Gnostic writings alluded to this entity called Sophia as the demiurgos, a Greek word that means half creator. Again, according to Gnostic beliefs, messengers of light came forth from the earliest times, sent by the true God in order to assist men in their quest for gnosis, or knowledge. The Gnostics argued that Jesus Christ functioned as one of the most important of these emissaries. Therefore, a Gnostic would believe that since Jesus Christ did not really have a fleshly body, he only seemed to be a human being. Gnostics did not look to salvation from sin, whether original sin or practical sin. Instead, Gnostics looked forward to deliverance from ignorance, of which sin was a consequence. Only gnosis, or knowledge, can dispel ignorance of spiritual realities. The messengers of the light, especially Jesus Christ, who Gnostics call the Logos, Word of the true God. The messengers of light brought the decisive revelations of gnosis to the human race. Thus, Gnosticism taught that Jesus Christ performed his work of salvation not through his shed blood and atoning death on the cross of Calvary, but through his teachings. During the New Testament era, Gnostic belief pervaded a number of local Christian congregations. In his epistle to the Colossians, for example, Paul exhorted the Colossian believers, quote, "Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshipping of angels, intruding into those things which he hath not seen," unquote. Paul could have alluded to Gnostic teachers. John, in his epistles, also could have alluded to Gnosticism when he referred to individuals that, quote, "went out from us, but were not of us." From Gnostic belief, we look to another aspect of New Testament doctrine, namely the ministry of Jesus Christ himself. The advent of Jesus Christ took place in a culture where Judaism formed the major religious belief. The Jewish religion of that time, though, differed significantly from the beliefs and practices of the Old Testament. That was true in a number of areas. Observant Jews divided the Mosaic Law into two components. The written law appeared in the earliest books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. However, the oral law, which according to Orthodox Jewish belief was something that God gave to Moses, the oral law, even though it wasn't written down, had the same authority as the written law. Furthermore, a number of regulations, referred to by Jewish commentators as fences, a number of regulations existed in order to hinder Jews from violating God's commandments by setting up barriers, much in the same way that a highway construction firm might erect guardrails on a mountain road to keep drivers from coming too close to the edge of the thoroughfare. The Jewish historian Josephus wrote about one temple for the one God. The Jews saw themselves as a unique people, worshiping the one true God in a temple designed by God. Therefore, the temple served as a powerful unifying source within the Jewish community. Solomon initiated the construction of the first temple. However, the Babylonian armies conquered Jerusalem and removed the sacred vessels from that edifice. The Jews, led by Ezra and encouraged by Haggai and Zechariah, the Jews refurbished that structure when they returned from exile in Babylon. The book of Ezra contained the account of how God prospered that endeavor. In B.C. 19, Herod the Great began a reconstruction project on the temple. This undertaking continued to go on, even during the time of Jesus Christ. A Jewish remark directed to Jesus Christ, as recorded in John chapter 2, indicated this. Quote, 40 and 6 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? Unquote. That particular building project would not end until A.D. 63, long after Herod the Great had died. The priests and Levites functioned as the principal ministrants of the temple service. The priests offered sacrifices and exercised judicial functions, such as determining varieties of leprosy. The Levites assisted the priests in the daily service, while also assuming the role of temple singers and gatekeepers. Certain Levite families had certain tasks assigned to them. For example, the group known as the Sons of Korah were designated as gatekeepers for the temple. Sacrificial worship took place daily, including the Sabbath day and the days of the various festivals. A standby group of lay Israelites, known as Ma'amid, from the Hebrew word meaning assembly or group, a standby group of Israelites usually represented their brethren from various sections of the country. They would attend these services. The entire Jewish population formed 24 such ma'amidotes, or groups, to correspond with the number of the priestly and Levite entities. This innovation provided the entire Jewish nation with a sense of participation in the temple services. Although the Bible contained no references to the program followed during the sacrificial services, worship in the Second Temple featured prayers, blessings, and readings from the Pentateuch, or first 5 books of the Old Testament. At the conclusion of the incense offering, the priests would bless the general assembly. Indeed, the Jews today still recite the priestly blessing in synagogues throughout the world. Music and song contributed to the beauty of divine worship. At various points in the daily sacrificial ceremonial, the Levites joined in the ceremony with singing. They also chanted a special psalm for each day of the week. Some men ministered on stringed instruments, such as the 10-string lyre mentioned in Psalm 32. Others, such as Heman and Jeduthun, played cymbals and trumpets. At each of the trumpet choruses, the people fell down and worshiped God. David subdivided that priesthood into 24 groups, who took regular turns. This practice enabled all of the priests to participate in the ministrations, at one time or another. Each priestly group had a corresponding Levitical group. There existed a further subdivision of the priestly groups into Bate Avots, literally households. Each household was responsible for a specific number of days of temple services. Special attendees at temple services included a physician, a choir master, and a special officer who was in charge of the priestly vestments. This concludes our study for today. Thank you very much for listening. We invite you to return for future programs relating to New Testament times.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee, 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.